or issues to deal with? All right. Then again, we finished yesterday with this opening case of Dillon versus Legg. The standard that the court adopted, which was essentially this flexible standard of saying it depends on whether the plaintiff was at the accident scene, it depends upon whether the plaintiff suffers this direct emotional injury as opposed to natural kind of grief or emotional trauma from having a loved one suffer a serious injury. And finally, the question of how closely related the plaintiff is to the person who was actually injured. Now, we're switching here on page 91 to Hagel versus McMahon, which is actually a combination of two different Washington cases consolidated for purposes of this appeal because they raise a common question. That is, what's the status of the law in Washington? What's the burden of proof in Washington for a plaintiff to recover for these kinds of claims? So can somebody tell us about Hagel? Not the dialectic, but yes, Mr. Starnes, go ahead. What would be medical evidence? Yeah. What kind of a doctor? Yeah. One of those guys. Yeah, okay. Okay. So a doctor of psychology would also qualify as a that's medical treatment. What are we distinguishing? In other words, it's not necessarily that you have to find some, you know, X-ray or blood test that shows evidence of emotional trauma. What is the court distinguishing by way of saying, well, there are some claims that generate medical evidence and there are some claims that don't? What's the distinction here? Some identified medical condition. So, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, if that has an entry in the manual, the DSM-4 or whatever they're working on, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that lists all these mental diseases or and the like, if it has an entry in there and you can say, hey, this person suffers from this, I have the same indicators for this condition that I would have to show that somebody has smallpox or pneumonia. If you can get that kind of diagnosis, you've got medical evidence. As distinguished from simply saying, I feel terrible, I can't sleep, I can't work, a series of subjective complaints where there's been no evaluation by a doctor or a medical, someone with medical expertise who is has in some way verified the objective nature of the plaintiff's condition. Now, notice this isn't very much. It's more of a kind of bureaucratic process than it is a real limitation. I don't know if in your criminal law class you look at the Hinckley case, U.S. versus Hinckley, when John Hinckley shot President Reagan and James Brady, and was later tried for his behavior, put on trial, charged with several crimes, attempted murder and the like. He had a defense of insanity. And the diagnosis of his condition was narcissistic personality disorder. He was so obsessed with impressing Jodie Foster, he wanted his name forever to be associated with, you know, whenever people talked about Jodie Foster, they would have a little footnote that says she was the one that John Hinckley was trying to impress when he tried to, when he either assassinated or tried to assassinate the president. The psychiatrist diagnosed this as a narcissistic personality disorder. In other words, he cared more about his own feelings and his own agenda than he did about the fact that this would cost somebody else their life. That's a distortion of reality to kind of place your own needs ahead of the needs of other people, not to have a balanced perspective. Well, if that's a diagnosable psychiatric condition, then it's hard to imagine someone's emotional distress that wouldn't fit into some kind of diagnosis of a medical, of being psychiatrically disturbed. If you can't find a psychologist or a psychiatrist who will fit your mental distress into some category, then you haven't looked very hard, might be the response. Nonetheless, it still separates people who are at least willing to jump through those hoops to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist to describe their condition, to have the psychologist put it under one of these headings and say, yes, I've been treating this person for this disorder, I've prescribed the following treatment, maybe there's some medication that I thought would help them, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's one criterion of whether or not there is this objective medical symptomology as distinguished from a purely subjective, gee, I really feel bad. What else does the court want to know in terms of applying the litmus test or the gatekeeper function of figuring out which claims qualify and which ones don't? Okay, and if we go back to the previous case of Dillon versus Legg, the mother actually watches this car crash in which her daughter is fatally injured. If dad had been in the backyard mowing the lawn, races out and sees the, you know, carnage on the roadway, but wasn't actually there when the vehicle struck his daughter, the question is, does that make a difference? And I think as we talked about yesterday, there is a precedent that the defendant would like to cite and say, based on this previous precedent, you have to be at the accident scene. What was the previous precedent? At least that's one of the factors. Yeah, one of the three factors. But there's a previous Washington case. This isn't the first time. The case I was thinking of was Gain versus Carroll Mills, where the brother and the father of a state trooper are looking at a TV report that shows the state trooper's car, and they announce there's been a fatal accident involving a state trooper. They recognize the car as belonging to their brother and son, as the case may be. And they said, we suffered, you know, because we were virtually there. And the court, in response to that claim, said, because you weren't at the accident scene. Now, again, just sort of as the process of common law development here, as the plaintiff, as an advocate, encounters this previous precedent that appears to say you must be at the accident scene in order to recover, what does the plaintiff say in this case to try to justify an award? Well, what factually can the plaintiff say about this case that distinguishes it from Gain versus Carroll Mill? They got there, yeah. As distinguished from the father and the brother who only saw it on TV, never got to the accident scene, these people got there. So again, you could draw the line as you're trying to decide who qualifies and who doesn't. Dad in the backyard mowing the lawn, so long as he gets out to the accident scene while his daughter's lifeless form is still on the pavement, that qualifies. But if they put her body put her while she's still alive in the ambulance and taken her away, that's too late. Then you're like Gain versus Carroll Mills. So what does the court say about Hagel? Is that, are we close enough here? Can we do business with the plaintiffs here? Replead this case, in effect, to say, as long as you set it up in the right way, then you've got a viable claim. We can do business with the plaintiffs in this case. What about this other case, MacTolf or whatever it is? Yeah. It's essentially the same case. There's no real distinction here between his type of damage and their type of damage. Now, has the court made the right decision in terms of allowing those claims where people are actually at the accident scene as distinguished from people who never get there prior to the time that the victim is put in an ambulance or otherwise taken away? Yeah. If you stand to get a contingency fee from, from the standpoint of saying, gee, this is a sort of arbitrary line to draw, is it not? The degree of pain, grief, emotional dislocation, all of the sort of symptomology, you know, from a psychologist or psychiatrist standpoint, the presentation, as it were, of a patient who had just experienced what these people experienced, as opposed to someone who didn't get there till after the ambulance had already picked up the victim and started to take them away, it doesn't seem like there would be a huge difference in terms of the emotional trauma that the person would suffer. Nonetheless, at least it provides a nice bright line that we can distinguish. Some cases will qualify, some cases will not. As with the medical symptomology, if you get to the point of saying, I've been treated by a medical professional, here's the medical professional's diagnosis, here's the treatment that I've been undergoing for this condition, well, that has reached a certain threshold that's going to distinguish certain people from all the other, God forbid one of us should get run over by a truck and we're in the hospital and the rest of us, you know, members of the same study group or people who are in the same section of legal research and writing, roommate, good friend from college, etc. Yeah, we're upset, grieved by this injury, but it's not clear that would be enough to qualify us to make a recovery. But those family members there at the accident scene who can get a psychologist report, they are eligible. Yeah. Right. I mean, one of the things that's disorienting about having a loved one or a close friend suffer one of these injuries is this sense it could happen to me. It disturbs our sense of security. Gee, I sort of take it for granted that I'll get up in the morning, I'll go do whatever it is I do, and I'll come home at night, and, you know, I have plans. And the idea that I could get run over by a truck as my friend was, my child, my spouse, my whatever, was just run over by a truck. I feel vulnerable. I feel, insecure. Whether I witness it or not, yes, witnessing it may make it worse, but in some ways, I think you could argue, if I were a parent and my kid were struck by a car, would I rather be there, at least to cradle my child's form, body, in their last moments, or would I rather be in Chicago on a business trip and get there 24 hours later? Maybe it's better for me, psychologically, to be there. Or maybe not. So, again, the whole business of kind of zeroing in on being at the accident scene may or may not be where we ought to focus our attention. Yes. Gee, can you hold the ambulance for a second? I need to get there before, Well, and you're identifying an argument that we are going to see quite frequently in Rodriguez and Bohrer and so forth, which is, in effect, this floodgates argument that we are opening Pandora's box once we permit claims of negligently inflicted emotional distress. There's a long list of people that would have plausible claims to. And if the only distinction between the eligible and the ineligible are these artificial things, like are you at the accident scene, then it isn't crazy to think that people would say, hey, he's already dead. Just, leave him there. I'll be there in 5 minutes. If I get there in 5 minutes, my lawyer tells me I'll be able to sue for this. Now, Maybe that's nutty, it probably is nutty, but again, there are people concerned about the extent to which the system is creeping toward a sort of lottery system in which everybody's taking, you know, a turn pulling the handle. They stick their nickel in and pull the handle and see if something will drop out of the bottom. Yeah, Mr. Starnes. I am finished. Go ahead.
I had a question. What exactly does the
Well, I would say that, particularly with respect to the Marzal case, the idea of going there, he's been run over by a bus, I mean, it's really gruesome. And if they come upon the accident scene while he's still, you know, in the hideous kind of condition, again, soldiers in combat see some, even they, or they're pretty hardened to worry about other things besides, you know, their feeling states. They're trying to stay alive and keep their comrades alive. But even they report these PTSD, recurrent memories of seeing somebody with their head blown off or, you know, with a leg flying off in the air or what have you. And so I think the idea is that to the extent you're trying to recover for the intrusive memory of seeing this horrible thing in your mind again and again, to the extent it's been cleaned up, there is a substantial change. When he was first struck, it's hideous. But the paramedics have come, put him on a gurney, covered him up with a blanket. His face has a bunch of bruises and, you know, cuts on it, but the really bad stuff is underneath the blankets and he's being taken in the ambulance. That doesn't count. I think that's the concept here. But obviously, you have this sort of slider bar, as we have in these other cases, in which you gradually change it from this over here to that over there. And again, we lack a bright line to say, oh, at this point, it's changed from being compensable to non-compensable. Again, notice how important the trial judge's role here is in being the gatekeeper. You qualify, I'll allow your case to proceed to trial. You don't qualify, I'm dismissing your claim. Appeal me if you like, or appeal my decision if you like, but I just don't think you qualify. And the judge has to make these subjective is not exactly the right word, judgment calls about whether something's close enough to the standard to go to trial. Mr. Harris. Yeah. That's the tramway, the gondola case. Right. Well, again, because the trial judge is given a fairly broad discretion in weighing these factors, and because relationships, when you say, again, distinguishing these cases from the wrongful death cases where it's statutorily driven, there are only certain classes of people, spouses, children, etc., where the standard here is a broad one of how close the relationship is, it's not dispositive that this person is not related by marriage or blood or otherwise. So you could say, gee, this was my, you know, I met this person when we were in the first grade together and we've been thick as thieves ever since. You know, I'm closer to this person than I am to my own siblings. That counts here. Where it doesn't count, where the statute says the following people may recover: spouse, children, parents, siblings, and you're not any of the above. So again, a person could say, yeah, I hadn't met this person before, But spending 20 minutes in this gondola where he's bleeding to death and I'm, you know, I was baptized in a sense into this relationship, the court doesn't have any limitation on saying, well, gee, I know this is unusual, but I think it qualifies. Yeah. Well, they're emotional, non-economic damages. You could treat it as an economic loss. That is, I'll pay you, if you miss 3 days of work because you were completely emotionally wrung out by this experience, and you had 12 sessions with a psychiatrist at $120 a session, okay, we'll pay your economic loss, but none of the underlying pain and suffering. You could do that, but the courts have shown no inclination to make that division. Again, this is one of the sort of, I would say, one of the recurring themes of tort reform, that one of the impulses of people in proposing tort reform is to say, let's compensate people for their economic loss, for wages, for medical expenses. Those are real. This miasmic stuff with how I feel, come on, get over it. And again, that's not a crazy dividing line, but historically, again, the tort system has treated the emotional suffering along with the economic loss as though they were part of a single package. And again, the idea is, in response to the floodgates, slippery slope, etc., the courts have tended to respond by saying, my goodness, don't you trust the jury? Can't juries evaluate and use all of their knowledge of the human condition to identify what's real and what's made up? So, again, that's the argument. Yeah. Right. Well, again, the category that you have to fit into is a close relationship. And family members are the ones who are most likely to have a persuasive claim to say, you know, I would feel bad if any one of you got run over by a truck, if you had pneumonia, if you whatever, but, you know, I have a more distant relationship with you than I do with my siblings or, you know, my children or my blood relations. If somebody, one of those people gets sick or hurt or suffers an injury, I will feel a much greater sense of responsibility. It strikes much closer to home. So, again, I would say that in this area where the courts are fashioning a remedy without any limitation by statute, they can take into account their own assessment of how strong a relationship is, rather than saying, unless you fit this label, you don't qualify. No, it isn't. Again, that's the thing we have in wrongful death cases, and it's the very thing. Again, in this Filippides case I mentioned yesterday, the question is, do we make a small adjustment in our thinking so that parents who are not only financially dependent upon their children, whom everybody agrees is included in the statutory list of beneficiaries, how about parents who are emotionally dependent on their children? that we still need to square with what the legislature has authorized. Here, because it's judge-made law, the judges are not bound by a similar kind of sacred text, as it were. Ms. Johnson? Yes, very much so. Right. Actually, as I recall, on page 102, in that case, this is number on the right-hand column on page 102, my recollection of that case is that she could recover. I think I just posed the question, and obviously she's not Marianne Rodriguez. She's not married to this guy. But unlike Marianne Rodriguez, she's at the accident scene. So she makes a claim as a bystander and is allowed, as I recall, at least to go forward with her case. The dismissal was reversed, or they permitted the case to go on. Whereas if she had been sitting at home, a 600-pound pipe drops on her fiancé, and she says, I want loss of consortium damages, the court would probably say, but who are you? You're not married to this guy. You plan to be, but you're not. Now, one other question that has arisen is, what happens if they then get married? Does the marriage, in effect, refer back, sort of like an amendment to a complaint, so that it is, what do you call that in the, relates back? Yeah, whatever that term is, so that it qualifies, you know, it fits the statute of limitations and all the rest. So, you know, again, some people would say, so long as they get married, then they qualify, but again, the rules, as I want to emphasize your first question, which is, it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And unfortunately, you have this crazy quilt kind of pattern as you go from Washington to Idaho to California to Nevada to Texas to Ohio. You will find a similar kind of question being raised, a kind of general consensus at the extremes. Well, obviously, no jurisdiction would recognize this claim. Every jurisdiction would recognize that claim. But as you get into these tough middle cases, you will have previous precedents that say we do or we don't recognize cases when they fall on this side of the line or that side of the line. Again, it's not only a question of the level of generosity that's permitted or the standard, it's who imposes it. How strict is the judge in being the gatekeeper versus to what extent does the judge simply say it's for the jury? Give them general criteria. Let the jury sort it out. Let's spend a few minutes, if we can, on Rodriguez, because Rodriguez now changes the focus away from the cases where the plaintiff is a witness to something grisly, to one in which the plaintiff says, I didn't see it, but I'm a victim too. And obviously the court in Rodriguez relies very much on Dillon versus Legg in setting the parameters for how to resolve such cases. So can somebody tell us about Marianne and Richard Rodriguez here? Kim.
Yes.
And as I've said before, her complaint in essence is, you dropped a 600-pound, you, the defendant, dropped a 600-pound pipe on our marriage. And therefore, I'm as much of a claimant here as my husband. Now, again, we're confronted with a body of judge-made law in which the rules for this kind of claim have not been set out by the legislature, but instead have evolved through a process of common law decision-making. And there's actually a case on point in California that explicitly addresses the question of whether to recognize claims for loss of consortium. What is that case? Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that name. But in this case, the court said, in effect, we're not going to go there. We don't allow claims for loss of consortium. So part of the plaintiff's task in this case, Marianne Rodriguez, has to persuade the court, don't follow that case. Overrule it. Replace it with a different rule. When are courts supposed to do that? Okay, but we have this principle in the law, stare decisis, let the decision stand. In the absence of some, the idea is courts are supposed to maintain the consistency of the law, and just because I disagree with what somebody said in a previous case doesn't mean that the law should depend upon the whims of whoever happens to be sitting in the chair of the court from time to time. What justifies the court in saying, well, normally we follow stare decisis, but not this time? One way, and again, this is a larger question about how judges make decisions. Judges look at, just to sort of summarize the basic process, if you're a judge and you want to overrule a previous case, you say, I don't want to follow that anymore. I think that rule stinks. Not only do I think that rule stinks, but I think it's my obligation as a judge to replace it with a better rule. What you do is you go back and you look at the rationale of the previous case. You say, what were they thinking when they decided this case, and do we still think that? If indeed we still think what they were thinking when they decided this case, then we ought to leave it alone. But to the extent we've changed our mind, who's we? Well, in some sense, the society, the court system. If we've changed our mind, then it's maybe time to re-examine this and say, are we sure we want to do this, continue to do this? Yeah. But one of the tasks of the court is to say, well, that was then and this is now. Suppose, for example, and you'll see the way the court dismantles this precedent to say, well, gee, we've looked at why they did that, and every reason we come up with, we find unpersuasive. We don't think any of this stuff anymore. And therefore, its power to persuade us, its power to to, in effect, compel our obedience to it is gone. Now, obviously, this is a game that can be played. It's a very complex judgment that courts make, and it's particularly important. I mean, in this case, let's recall, what is the defendant's argument with regard to the extent the plaintiff is saying, gee, this is a stupid rule. This court should no longer follow it. It no longer reflects the public policy of the state of California. How would the defendant answer that? It's a very simple answer. Ms. Williams? Exactly. If the people of the state of California no longer want to do this, then they have a legislature elected precisely to do that. If the legislature doesn't do it, maybe that tells us something about how bad it is, according to you. Now, you may think this stinks, but what do the people of the state of California think? How do we know what they think? Isn't the way we know what they think the way they elect legislatures and governors, et cetera? Yeah. Right. For what it's worth, I would say, if I were a judge responding to this, or a theoretician responding, I would say the persuasiveness of the argument that legislative silence does not imply consent, that is most persuasive in areas of the law that are technical or not on the radar screen of the average citizen of the state. So, for example, if you've got provision, subparagraph 12A5 of the bankruptcy code, in which the preference for secured creditors is subordinated to that of a purchase money security interest, I mean, people are not going to run down to the legislature and say, hey, this law stinks and I want you to change it. Whereas, it seems to me, an issue relating, for example, to wrongful death or to loss of consortium, if I go to my legislature and say, hey, look, my friend down the street, her husband got badly hurt in this accident, and apparently the law is she can't recover for her own injuries, I want you to change that. It's more to be expected in a case like that, as distinguished from one that falls so far below the radar screen that it's unrealistic to think that people would go to their legislature and try to change it. But that's just, it's one of the factors to be considered. Okay, now, again, what is the rationale in this Deschotel or Desantel case? What are the reasons that were given? Yeah. Sure, Captain. Okay. Who are you, in effect, said the court in that case? You, as a legal entity, you and your this is actually from Blackstone eventually, as you go far enough back, that at law, the husband and the wife were treated as a single legal entity, or as the Iowa court puts it, at common law, the husband and wife were one and he was the one. That the husband had legal standing in a way that the wife didn't. And again, what does the court do in saying, This was the rationale for this previous rule? They say, they shrink in horror. They say, well, we don't think that anymore. So to the extent this rule reflects an understanding that is no longer shared, the court says, it's a very good reason why we ought not to follow it, rather than to give it this stare decisis effect. What other principles supported? Yeah. Yeah, how would we figure out, how would a jury make an award to Marianne Rodriguez about the loss, the value of the society and companionship of her husband? I mean, how subjective, how imprecise is that? What's the court's answer to that concern? What's that? Yeah, this is sort of, we go back to Steinhauser, and though experts may disagree about this, It's a task to which the jury is ideally suited. So this, again, we're not persuaded by that. What else? Okay, again, fraudulent claims. Again, the court is saying, plaintiffs all the time claim that they were injured in a whiplash thing, and we don't throw cases, whiplash cases out because some people might be faking them. Again, we trust juries. What other reasons? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, and again, if you think about the reality of this kind of relationship, if you were representing the husband, Richard, presenting his claim to the jury and asking them to compensate him, one of the things as his lawyer that you would draw out is his sadness, his sense of loss in being unable to be, for his wife, the man that she fell in love with. And that this, if he's testifying on the witness stand, again, if I'm Richard's lawyer, I don't want to see a dry eye in the house when he's done describing how hard it is to look at his wife and think she must be miserable. Then Marianne gets up to testify in her case, and she says, it's so hard. This man I married, was so full of life, and we did all these things, and now, he's confined to a wheelchair, et cetera, et cetera. Again, not a dry eye in the house. Then Richard gets up and says, don't we have the potential here for a kind of escalation? I'm miserable because she's miserable because I'm miserable because, and so forth. But again, the court says that's no reason to forbid it. It's just something, again, to make sure the jury understands this is Marianne's recovery. Richard's recovery is a different matter. Now, the other thing the court is concerned about is and again, none of these are found to be persuasive. And the court says we're done. This case no longer persuades us. We're replacing it with a new rule. Are you concerned about floodgates? Nah, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Now, again, what's significant about Rodriguez, as you pick up in the Borer case, which we'll do tomorrow, is, as the dissenting opinion notes in Borer, all of the arguments that were found unpersuasive to limit recovery in Rodriguez are suddenly found persuasive by the majority in Borer to limit the recovery of children for loss of consortium with their parents. Were we lying then, or are we lying now, essentially? Or is there a meaningful distinction? Was it right for the court to permit a recovery here, but wrong to permit a recovery there? How do we reconcile these? So we'll pick that up tomorrow.